determine the home of the cyber school participant. They sent $152,000 to home schools from the kids that were registered. They kept a slightly smaller amount of that for themselves. Now, I want to go back and look at our charge. Our charge was to create or develop two types of charter schools. I would say to you, whereas the teachers are certified, whereas the curriculum meets or exceeds state standards, whereas the school meets the needs of many students, whereas the school has a statewide enrollment, therefore the cyber school, we feel, should be placed under the authority of the State Board of Ed. However, and I must say this is my conclusion, and I think Ben will take you to a different place. This is where he and I have a different notion. I believe that the 50% rule should be dropped. And the reason for that is there are 1,400 students presently in the Oregon Connection Academy. School is not something that you start one day and stop the next. Because there is an innovative school district, and that is the SIO school district, when you go out there, their superintendent, their board, their teachers are actively engaged in projects that would amaze you. They look at school through the prism of the student, and we were amazed. We look primarily at the Connection Academy, but we've had opportunity to visit with them about other things they were doing for students. They have grown to depend on the income that they generate in this program. And for that reason, I believe that the Oregon Connection Academy should be grandfathered in perpetuity, as it was intended and during the end game of the last legislative session. I must tell you, as I close, that I have a conflict of interest. My daughter, in the middle of all of this process, was hired by the Connection Academy. However, last night, her husband was accepted to grad school in Nevada, and she will be leaving the academy at the end of this term. I suppose that gives me a conflict up until June. I thank you very much. I'd be glad to answer any questions. We spent a lot of time at the academy. We spent a lot of time reviewing this issue. I know you're in a hurry, and I'm going to give it back to Ben.
All right, thank you. Representative Cannon, can you quickly wrap up?
Yeah, I'll try to be very brief. John focused his testimony on the Connections Academy. Our role as policymakers is to set good statute for the state of Oregon. I am concerned that in the absence of the 50% rule, we do not have adequate safeguards against a sort of wild and woolly virtual charter schools world. I want to ensure that my cousin in a basement in Vermont who has a degree in history can't open up a virtual school and offer it to the students of Oregon, a virtual charter school. And I think that the 50% rule, in the absence of clear statutory guidelines, standards, and regulations for virtual charter schools, is one way of ensuring that there is a district that is accountable for what's happening in that virtual charter school. And why, what does the 50% rule have to do with that? It's an imperfect and blunt sort of instrument at getting at this, but it does ensure that the chartering district is, that the majority of the kids in the school that of that come from that chartering district, and I think that provides a kind of democratic accountability for what's happening in that school district. John mentioned in his testimony in conclusion, I think we both reached, which is that if the state wants to encourage the development of charter virtual schools that serve the entire state's or can potentially serve the entire state's population, the appropriate chartering authority is the state, not a SIO school district which enrolls three kids in a school that serves 1,500. There's a kind of profit motive there. I don't want to cast aspersions at SIO at all, because I think they're doing what they have to do given the shrinking school funds. They're trying to find every penny, and one way they can get some pennies is by starting a school that attracts 1,500 kids from around the state and keeping that 5%. So, but it does create, I think, the kind of motive that we hope not to have in our schools. So I think that's a very sort of high level view of what John and I did and sort of some of the conclusions that we reached. Be happy to take any questions.
Okay, thanks. We have one question and we really need to move on.
Yeah.
Senator Moore.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for your indulgence. If the school is accredited by the Northwest Association, does the 50% rule really matter
Yes. Two separate issues. One, accreditation by the Northwest Association simply tells those that enroll in the school that that school suffers some sort of adjudication. The 50% rule is statute that says, now, the Connection Academy was grandfathered in the legislation at the end of last session, so they do not fall under the 50% rule right now. With 1,400 kids in cyber school, I'm not sure what their enrollment is, but it's a fraction of that. But they're two separate issues. The Northwest Association is an association of high schools and schools that have come together and decided that they would set a standard that they want high schools to meet. And I will say, having been through that process several times, it is a sound standard, and it does give people that go to that school some assurance that education is taking place in that system.
Madam Chair, I think it's very important to get on the record that waivers are available. So this 50% rule can be waived by the State Board of Education upon application by the charter school and assuming that the charter is meeting the criteria that's identified in statute. That 50% rule can be waived. That's not something we knew at the beginning of our work group, not something I knew, something that we did learn by the end.
Okay. Thank you. We will explore this matter further, and I appreciate your work on the other side of the building, and you just might get to just run with this because you're doing all the work. So we'll see.
Thank you again.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
All right, I'm going to call up Lori Wimmer-Whalen, Mara Steele, Paul Duchin, if you'll come up, please. When I get to the opposition testimony, which are many of you, I will be taking all of the people who live more than 100 miles away first, and then if we have time for others, that's what we'll do. Okay. And our time is short, and you're aware of that. Thank you. Good morning. Introduce yourself, please, even though we know who you are, all of you. Thank you for coming.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee member, for your record.
Lori Wimmer-Whalen. Oh, yeah, we're sort of a small committee at the moment.
Lori Wimmer-Whalen, representing Oregon Education Association and its 46,000 members in K-12 and community colleges. And with me today are two of those members who are the co-presidents of the Eugene Education Association, Mara Steele and Paul Duchin. I thought I'd start off just by giving you a very, very brief overview of why we're here today and why Senate Bill 621 is before you today at our request, and thank the chair for her agreement to co-sponsor that. In 1999, Oregon passed a charter school law, which OEA was involved in the negotiations of, and we did oppose it at the end because we could not agree on some of what we considered to be threshold issues related to student quality. Among those are guaranteeing the basic minimum standards to the consumers of education, that is, public school students in Oregon, the quality control that licensure offers as a baseline guarantee of quality and education and training. We believe that was the most objectionable provision of the bill when it passed in 1999, and we've worked ever since to try to restore 100% licensure, just as all other teachers in Oregon's system paid for by taxpayer dollars requires. We also feel that because charter schools proliferate where there is an interest by a charter starter and not necessarily where the students are within school districts, what tends to happen is that in declining enrollment districts particularly, the financial pressures are really unwieldy for school board members who are being asked to be fiduciarily responsible and even close schools, which is very painful to do. If for any of you who have been through that, closing a community school is very difficult. And yet, sometimes with declining enrollment, there is simply no other option. And nonetheless, charter starters will go into districts that are declining enrollment, as two-thirds of Oregon's districts are, and want to start charter schools in those districts, and that just thins the soup of available resources. So we had concerns about the caps for that reason, and they were originally in the law, but they did sunset over our objections, and so this bill would seek to restore those. And I bring your attention to the fact that the caps are that, first of all, at least 80% of students in a charter school come from within the sponsoring district. However, as your committee administrator has already said, we have requested an amendment for the virtual school charter schools to retain the 50% agreement. And the reason for that is we made a deal last session, and a deal's a deal. And the deal was 50%. And as you've heard with respect to the other bill that's been mentioned today, there are those who'd seek to zero that out. And while we oppose that, and I'll be talking about that later when you get to that bill, we would also feel that it was necessary to maintain that deal from our perspective, so not 80 but 50 for virtuals. The second cap is that no more than 10% of students in any one district be enrolled in a charter program. Again, uncontrolled growth is an issue, and finances are as well. And finally, we want to make sure that because it's difficult to identify the employer of record for the person for the purpose of personnel representation, we'd ask that the sponsor be considered the employer for the purposes of collective bargaining, so that if employees elect to, they can be members of a collective bargaining unit. So those are the basic elements of the bill and the amendment that we have sought. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to the real experts in the room who work with the students every day in Oregon's public schools. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mary. Good morning, Senator Walker.
Good morning.
Nice to see you, Senator
Nice
Morse.
To see you.
My name is Paul Duchin. I am licensed by the Teachers Standard and Practices Commission as a K-12 math teacher and K-8 elementary teacher. I've taught in the Eugene Public Schools for over 20 years. Currently, I serve as the co-president of the Eugene Education Association, representing the licensed employees in the Eugene, 4J, and Bethel school districts.
My name is Mara Steele. I am licensed by TSPC as a speech and language specialist, and have worked as a speech and language pathologist in the Eugene Public Schools for over 20 years. Currently, I serve as the other co-president of the Eugene Education Association.
Ms. Steele and I have spent the past 8 years investigating public charter schools as they would pertain to the Eugene School District. We have made two pilgrimages to the Mecca of the charter school movement, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, to learn firsthand the impact of public charter schools on the local public school systems. We didn't undergo the study of charter schools because we wanted to visit Milwaukee in the middle of February, but because the Eugene 4J School District was being pressed by diverse groups to initiate and implement public charter schools. Our second visitation to Milwaukee included teachers, District 4J administrators, and a 4J school board member. This second visit to Milwaukee assisted EEA in forming OEA legislative objectives concerning charter schools that were implemented by the Oregon Education Association Representative Assembly. Additionally, in collaboration with the Deputy Eugene 4J Superintendent, the Eugene 4J School Board adopted policy concerning in-district charter schools, similar to the legislative objectives approved by OEA members. In both cases, these policies remain in effect, and at the conclusion of this, we have copies of those if they would be filed.
Okay.
For purposes of discussion, Ms. Steele and I would like to distinguish between two types of public charter schools. The first type of charter school is what we term an out-of-district charter school. While this school is technically part of the public schools, the charter was not initiated by the district, or a district employee is not subject to the same regulations that apply to other Eugene schools. By board policy, an in-district charter school in Eugene refers to a public charter school where the charter was initiated by a district employee and is subject to all of the regulations that apply to other Eugene schools.
The issue of licensure has been paramount for EEA. Allowing public charter schools to require only 50% of the teachers to be licensed by TSPC has in numerous cases resulted in unqualified individuals teaching public school students compensated by public dollars. The standards laid out by TSPC are rigorous for a reason. We want the very best and only those licensed by TSPC to be teaching in our public school students. The use of public money to support unqualified instructors flies in the face of all the regulations set out by TSPC and No Child Left Behind.
Eugene currently has 3 out-of-district charter schools. We had a 4th out-of-district charter school, but it moved to another local school district and is currently operating under a new name. From the outset, funding has been an issue. A large infusion of dollars created situations where programs were not easily maintained or sustained. The adverse impact of allowing charters to draw more than 20% of their student population from outside the boundaries of the sponsoring district must be changed. The inability of districts to plan programs because of fluctuating enrollment caused by movement to a neighboring charter school impacts FTE and a host of other financial concerns. Children who elect to attend the traditional public schools are hurt when the district's finances are untenably stretched. We care about the students in charter schools, and we also care about the children in the traditional programs. Additionally, capping charter school enrollment within a district student's population is reasonable and will allow for sustained program development within the sponsoring district.
As a speech and language specialist, I was assigned to provide services to an out-of-district charter school. Well, I found in many ways that it was no different than the regular public schools. There was one notable exception. Part of working with students with special needs, especially in my area, requires consulting with those teachers who work with students. However, I quickly found that the non-licensed instructors did not have the background to understand or implement the suggestions that were provided. Additionally, part of working with special needs students requires providing feedback about progress on generalization. And generalization means the student's ability to learn, to use learned skills in the classroom. Non-licensed instructors were frequently unable to provide accurate feedback, potentially hampering student progress. All special education students have individualized educational plans under federal law. It is simply not an option to be cavalier about implementation of a student's IEP, yet an unqualified education employee who cannot execute the plan is evidence that we're not being good guardians of students' educational rights in this regard. Just as I am required to have proper accreditation, the same should apply to all public school teachers. Thank you for your time and the opportunity to address you on these matters that are critical to the success of public school students. We urge you to support passage of Senate Bill 621. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Marks, do you have any questions? Okay. Part of the reason we're going to hold some of our questions is we want to hear from a lot of people today. I really appreciate your testimony. It sort of outlines the issues that we need to be concerned about. And you have written testimony you can submit to us. All right. Thank you very much. And thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Hold down the fort in Eugene.
Okay.
All right. I'm going to call up Vicki Chamberlain. She'll be the last person to speak before we get to the opponents. And I need Vicki to talk about the teacher licensure issue because that one's a big concern. So.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Vicki Chamberlain, Executive Director, Oregon Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. And I didn't hear the last part of your sentence.
I'd like you to address the teacher licensure issue. Are there alternative licenses available to people who teach in charter schools, and what are they? And how do you control who's teaching our kids in these public charter schools?
Well, Madam Chair, I have written testimony. I'll give it to you when I'm done. It's only one page.
Okay.
Today, TSPC really has no control over registered charter school teachers. We are required by law to fingerprint all registered charter school teachers, and the law says that if they are not licensed as a teacher, they must be registered with us. And what our scope is on those fingerprints is this. If they've been licensed in another state and that license has been revoked or suspended, then the commission has the right and the duty to deny the registration. So that would be a rare instance, but that would prevent someone who had lost their license in another state and coming in and being registered as a charter school teacher. And then the other scope we have on that is that only if they are convicted of fairly serious crimes, what we call the mandatory crimes in Oregon, may we deny a registration. So the scope of everything in between there is they could be convicted of many crimes, But if they're not convicted of those specific crimes, we can't deny their registration. We can take action against their registration if after we've registered them, they become convicted of one of these crimes. Actually, I'll give you this testimony so that you can see them. And we have had a letter from legislative counsel as it relates to No Child Left Behind. They are required to be highly qualified, which means they are required to meet the federal definition of highly qualified teacher, which means they must have, at a minimum, a bachelor's degree and evidence that they have subject matter competence in the core academic subjects.
That's a requirement from the federal government for our schools under NCLB. Does that apply to charter schools?
Yes, ma'am, it does. And how charter schools are different is that the federal law says a public charter school teacher has to be licensed, have a bachelor, and have subject matter competency. And then it says for charter school teachers, they must have a bachelor's in subject matter competency. They don't have to have the license. So to be highly qualified, a math high school charter school teacher would have to have a bachelor's degree and either a major coursework equivalent to a major, a master's in math, or have passed a math test. Okay. To meet the federal definition.
So the only difference is federal guidelines say you don't have to be a licensed teacher, but
correct,
you have to meet other
correct
requirements.
An elementary teacher would have to demonstrate the same subject matter competency they would have had if they're new, to
okay
have passed a multiple subjects test or have a background.
Okay.
And the final part that you asked about additional licensure, if this proposal goes into effect and they're required to be licensed, then TSPC, I think, would have to look seriously at how we would do alternative licensure, because currently alternative licensure requires that any school district today could apply for and receive a license for an educator who hasn't completed teacher preparation for 3 years. And at the end of that 3 years, they are required by law to have completed teacher preparation. And short of the emergency license or a limited license, which is not a full license, that is what we have right now. And I would submit to you that there would have to be a conversation about what the legislature expects with regard to how they would like TSPC to step in and do the licensure role. But if we did license them, it would increase our scope of ability to police the ethics of those candidates, because the final part of my testimony is that today we can act on a license for every K-12 educator if they misuse public resources, if they use physical force against students, if they appear on duty under the influence of alcohol, if they access pornography on computer equipment at school. Those are all very actionable and serious events we consider, and we have no reach over registered charter school teachers in that regard. That would have to be handled through the local administration. And on that point, charter school administrators are not required by law to be licensed.
Okay. Ms. Chamberlain, your testimony was extremely valuable and informative, and you've left the written testimony with the clerk. Okay, great. So we will take a look at that. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Okay, we're going to go into the opposition now, and I've promised Ms. Kaika she could have the last 5 minutes. So at 9 o'clock, I'll stop and give Ms. Kaikas the I have a friend whose last name is Kaikas. The last 5 minutes to sum up. So let's start out. I'm sorry if you came here with somebody. You're going to get to meet new people. I'm calling people three at a time. So out of town, over 100 miles, we'll start out with Rachel Nightshade. Let's see, and there was somebody else from Rachel Nightshade, Mark Jeffrey, and Paul Mayhew. And you.
I would be willing to surrender my time and submit written testimony. We have some students here. I think we're out of here for a moment.
Okay, and I don't know who's a student and who's not, and I don't know who you are, so.
I'm sorry, I'm Superintendent Jeffrey, Mark Jeffrey.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Jeffrey. Then if there's a student here, you can come forward and take his place. And we will limit your testimony to 2 minutes each. So introduce yourself and get started, please.
My name is Rachel Nightshade.
Rachel Nightshade, okay.
And my name is Paul Mayhew.
Okay.
And I guess we'll just start now. Members of the committee, my name is Rachel, and I attend a charter school called Armadillo Technical Institute in Phoenix, Oregon. I think that it's important for kids these days to have options when it comes to choosing which school they want to go to. For example, myself, I used to go to a traditional public high school in Ashland, and I always got good grades, but I was miserable. I never received the help that I was supposed to. There was just too many kids in each class. Half the time, there weren't even enough materials to go around. But at ATI, the classes are small, and there's usually 10 to 15 kids in each class, as opposed to 35 or sometimes 40 in regular public schools. So now when I need help with something, I actually receive the attention I was told I would get at public schools but never did. The main problem with this Bill 621 is the kids who live outside the district need to come to school too. And as long as we're open, kids will come here. And wouldn't you want your children to have options regardless of what district they're from? If there were charter schools in their own district, they wouldn't travel so far to Phoenix every day. We've got kids coming from Eagle Point 40 miles every single day because we're the only charter school in Jackson County. And so we've got five districts full of kids that need to come to school because they didn't succeed in public schools. So basically just what I'm saying is, in conclusion, I hope that you and the members of the committee really consider what I've said and what dozens of my classmates and teachers have said. The school is necessary for our students and everyone in our county. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Nightshade. I'm sorry. We cannot have that kind of display in this room. We have to maintain decorum, so please hold your clapping, laughter, all those kinds of things. Thank you. Mr. Mayhew?
Okay. Members of the committee, my name is Paul Mayhew, and I attend the charter school Armadillo Technical Institute in Phoenix. I came to this school after spending my middle school years being homeschooled, and the reason I came was because it's a small school, and I was not used to having many people around me, so me and my parents thought it would be better if I was in a small school or I would not be distracted by multitudes of other students. At ATI, the maximum number of students that have attended at one time is 120, and this means that there is less distraction and also a higher ratio of student-to-teacher interaction, which involves better teaching. There's an average of 12 students in each class compared to 30 or 40. It gives a student a better chance of doing work and actually understanding it, and gives a student a much better chance of retaining the knowledge earned. Now, all the students are like me and chose the school because of its size. Some students came here because they have no choice. Some of our students came here because no other school would accept them. They're getting into fights, ditching classes, and failing school. The school is in some cases a last chance, and it definitely saved many people, some of whom I know. ATI is not a problem school. It is a school that is made to focus on the use of computers and offer a small community-like environment. It is made to be a school for anyone. Now, I do admit that some of the students are problem kids, but every school has problem kids, and they're not the only people that are here. This is a school for anyone that needs it. Other students came here during middle school simply because they were advancing faster than the students around them and they wanted a smooth transition into high school. These students are not problem students. They are simply coming here to learn at a faster rate, which ATI allows. ATI allows students to advance as much as they want as long as it does not disrupt the class. Other students came here simply because it is their closest option. I came because of size and because closest to where my mother works, because I'm too far out for a bus. She is my only ride to school, and location is important. If only students from the Phoenix Talent School District are allowed to come to this school, many people will lose the only chance they have left.
Okay, Mr. Mayhew, I'm sorry, but your 2 minutes are up. We have your written testimony.
Okay.
And I appreciate it. So we'll go now. Next, can you move the microphone a little closer to this young man? State your name for us.
I am Mitchell Harlow.
Okay.
I attend ORCA. And I have what's called dysgraphia, a learning disability. That was my main problem while I was in school. Well, what dysgraphia does is it makes writing and life in general heck. And these public schools didn't help. I didn't get everything I needed For instance, when I had to print something out, I had to go home, print it out, come back the next day, and by the time I turned it in, it was late. I didn't always have access to a printer, so I had to use the one at home. Now with Orca, I have everything I need pretty much right at my fingertips.
You're doing just fine. Do you have one more comment that you'd like to make?
Yes, I have another comment.
Okay.
If you pass any of these bills, you're taking stuff away from children and possibly even adolescents such as me, and you're forcing us into pretty much... No, I'll admit that. Mm-hmm.
All right. Are you through, Mr.
Yes,
Marlowe?
I'm through.
Well, thank you for your testimony. I appreciate all three of you. I appreciate the comment you made that you're the only charter school in Jackson County, and you all had very good comments to make. Thank you. Okay. I'm going to call up Don McDonald, Frank LaRoche, and Velma Hartwig.
Serving on education.
One more slot open.
Okay, one more slot open. Then, let's see, I'm going to all these 100 miles or further. Michael Warner. Okay, you've got your 2 minutes. Who would like to start?
Thank you very much for giving us this opportunity to express our concerns regarding Senate Bill 621.
And your name, sir?
No, I'm sorry. I'm Don McDonald.
That's okay. I even forget when I testify in committee. So.
Okay, good. Now I don't feel so bad.
Okay.
Don McDonald. I'm the administrator of Eddyville Charter School in Lincoln County. For my colleagues from the union, I am also licensed by TSPC.
Okay.
In social science, I'm also have a handicapped learner specialist license, and I am a school administrator licensed by TSPC.
And I have been to your school when it was not a charter school.
Correct.
Several years ago, we took a tour. So
that's right. I remember.
I know where your school is.
Yeah. I'll make this real short. I realize we're pressed on time. And I hope people don't take this in a negative way, but looking at the source of or the sponsors of this bill, we're looking at the Oregon Education Association. I've never viewed the Oregon Education Association as big fans of charter schools. Charter schools in this state, along with the other 40-odd states that they exist in, represent choice for parents and students. And charter schools are varied. They offer a multitude of opportunities for kids that aren't available in traditional neighborhood schools. When we talk about the source of this bill, I've never been aware of public outcry about the quality of education provided in charter schools. I've never heard about concerns that, gee, we wish all the teachers were unionized. I haven't heard public outcry about, boy, there's just too many kids in charter schools. Charter movement is based on choice and competition. I think OEA wants to limit the competition.
Okay,
thank you,
sir. Thank you very much. And
my name is Velma Hartwig.
Welcome.
First, before I start my statement, I would like to invite all of you to come out and see for yourself what a charter school is like. We have the best school in the whole county.
Are you at Eddyville also?
I live in Harlan, and my grandson goes to Eddyville.
Okay.
Okay, this bill will destroy charter schools if allowed to pass. I do not understand why anyone would want to do that. And I'm sure this committee certainly wants our children to have the best education possible. If the schools are forced to require teachers and administrators to have an Oregon license, it will destroy the diverse opportunities now afforded to the students. For instance, In our school in Eddyville, we have a certified master mechanic teaching shop. He doesn't have a teacher's license. When our children graduate from his class, they will not only be able to work on their automobiles, but will also be able to repair their tractors, their baling machines, their trucks, and any other equipment on their farms and ranches. What about those trained artists, musicians, CPAs, master chefs, and others who are willing to lend their time and efforts to educate our children? Having a teacher's license does not guarantee quality education. Charters already have to comply with highly qualified teachers' regulations. Why would anyone want to deprive our children of a better education and destroy our charter schools and their chance to learn from the experts? The other requirements that are obviously nothing more than an attempt to destroy the charter schools. Forced memberships and unions, why?
Okay, that's your 2 minutes, and that's a great way to end with that question.
All right.
Why? We'll leave that hanging.
I hope this committee will see through this ploy and say a loud, resounding no to this bill.
Okay, great. Thank you for your testimony. I appreciate it. You, sir, are?
My name is Michael Warner.
Okay.
I'm the co-director of Armadillo Technical Institute in Phoenix, Oregon. I'm a past president of the Oregon Association for Alternatives in Education. I served on the state's Charter School Task Force. I've been working in alternative programs and charter schools for 26 years. I helped start Pioneer Trails, drug and alcohol program in Roseburg, worked at Phoenix School in Roseburg, which many of you probably know about, when we only had 35 students. Basically, what I want to say is Senate Bill 621 is a solution looking for a problem, because the things that they're bringing up aren't current problems. The issues that are brought up around pulling students out of mainstream schools, there's no evidence that we have that kind of an effect. I'm sure the 13 students, new students we had this year from throughout Jackson County who opted to leave their public schools to come to our school, so that's out of four school districts, and 12,000 kids has devastated the finances of those districts. All they have to do if they want to keep more kids in is start the programs that attract them. We would support them doing that. This bill will prevent that from happening, because it will create new and more difficult barriers for charter schools, which means that areas like Eagle Point and Central Point and Medford and Ashland will be less likely to have those programs, which means even if you grandfather us in, kids are going to wind up coming, leaving the county. This penalizes rural districts. The 80% rule is not an issue in urban districts. It's an issue in rural districts, and the reason it is because no single rural district can start a program for a subpopulation, particularly at-risk youth, and make it run with only the students in its own district. So it means you have to duplicate services. For example, about 10% of our population have been diagnosed with Asperger's. It's very unlikely that they're all going to do one for a program for that. So my 2 minutes.
Oh, your 2 minutes.
Okay, thank you very much.
Sorry.
No, that's okay.
And your testimony was cogent.
And I've got some written stuff.
Okay, any written stuff, you can send that over there to Ms. Gravel, and she'll make sure we all get it, and I appreciate it. All right, thank you all for coming. Okay, we just have a couple of more out-of-towners, and then we'll just start down the list. Let's see, Ed Johnston and Amanda Ulrich, you are out of town, and then I'm going to go back up to the top of the list, Linda Duman.
I know.
Okay, we're doing pretty well. We've got 2 minutes for you. Mr. Johnston, do you want to go first?
Good morning. My name is Edward Johnston, Lincoln County taxpayer, and very disturbed with my public schools the way they're running now. They're not educating our schools. Our charter schools are doing a much better cause for the general public. Dealing with recalling the school board in Lincoln County in 2003, I've had many, you can sort of say, attempts of my safety because of that. And it concerns me when we have public employees pushing to control the general public of our schools. The general public exactly for the charter schools, have an entitlement to be separate from the public schools and to not be controlled in any manner. If we are the people of the United States of America, in a state called Oregon, the citizens do have this internal and legal right instead of just being turned over and having the unions going to be dictating to our general public on how we're going to be teaching our children. This belongs to the communities 100% and does not have any influence and should not have any influence from the unions. And that's what horrifies me about these bills that they're trying to do. This is our union attack on the general public to control it so that way we do not have the right to teach our children in our way, and so that way the state dictates to our children how they're going to be taught. The general public, I believe, and I speak loudly and clearly, does not want that. We have the right to teach our children. We want to keep that right, and we would like and respect the Senate and House to cherish their oath they took to the Constitution and keep our rights so that way we can teach our children, and so the next generation is known for freedom. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Just a little editorial comment from me. This is not an attack by the union.
Okay.
Okay, I appreciate
being corrected, Senator Walker, especially on that, but dealing with what I have gone through in Lincoln County, which this House and Senate is aware from the attempts that have been made on me, that it does make me concerned on how sometimes the backdoor loop does work in that direction.
All right, thank you. Just wanted to correct the record. All right, next.
My name is Linda Duman. I am from the Lourdes Public Charter School. We were the first charter school in the state. We are just finishing our eighth year.
Which charter school is that, Ms. Duman?
Lourdes Public Charter
and
School.
And located where?
Lynn County.
Oh, okay. Great.
In the Scio School District.
Great. Thank you.
Our school is actually 108 years old. We were a school that was mandated to close because of the one-size-fits-all legislation in the 90s. Rural Oregon does not have educational choice. The merger bills in the 90s eliminated that. For us, charter schools is the only choice that we have. And this is very important. Boyer said in his speaking on community schools, it's very important to have schools in the community. I'm just going to speak to two things that would harm us in this particular legislation, and this wasn't needed for our 8 years of existence, and that is the 80%. We have a cap of 49 students in our school. If we have one person that graduates and is an in-district student and two siblings come into the school, we no longer have 80%. Our school is right on the boundary. We have people from out of district that can see our school, can come a mile to our school, but it's a 10-mile drive to the nearest district school or 20-mile bus ride. That's just the way it is in rural Oregon. And this is just an unnecessary bill for that. Also, collective bargaining. In our particular situation, we receive under $200,000 SSF monies. Given the insurance cost, given the salary increases, our budget would increase $48,000 next year.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony. If you had any written testimony?
I have written testimony.
Okay, you can submit that to Ms. Gravel. And you, ma'am?
Hi, I'm Amanda Ulrich.
Okay.
I'm a student of Armadillo Technical Institute in Phoenix. And I was at one time one of those high-risk, very high-profiled students you guys have been hearing about. But over the years I've spent with ATI, I have not learned only to control anger problems and home problems and other issues that don't involve how you act at school or around people in society. Armadillo has taught me everything I've needed to know to become a person that's strong in society. One of you guys that stand up there every day and have to listen to what we have to say, and it takes a lot. I'm so scared right now.
Whoa, well, we wouldn't know it at all. You're doing just fine.
But
I'm doing great.
These schools, they don't just teach us about our education. They give us the tools we need to do to live our lives. I mean, we do. We have a lot of students that are out of district because they cannot function properly in high school. they get into too many fights. They can't get along with the teachers, and it's just the overpopulation of students is just unbearable. They walk in there, and they get these shields over their eyes where they just feel like they cannot move, think, or do anything. And that's what this charter school does, is it motivates, and it makes you feel comfortable enough to where you can learn, and you can interact with others. That's all I really want to say. Thank
okay,
you.
Okay, well, that was very nice. Thank you very much, both of you. Okay, we've got about 2 minutes. Is there... before I turn it over to Ms. Hykus, is there anyone in this group that has a burning desire to testify in the last 2 minutes? Okay, I'll split it between the two of you. This gentleman and this woman here, if you'll come forward, and you'll take the last 2 minutes.
We got a minute apiece, right?
Yeah, we got a minute.
I'll give you a minute and a half each, so here you go. Introduce yourself, please.
My name's Wendy, and I'm the Executive Treasurer of Victory Alliance.
And Wendy, what is your last
Myers.
Name?
Myers.
Thank you.
Back here we have three young men, John, James, and Jonah. They're my J's cubed. We are all at Connections Academy. We're going to focus mostly on James and John here today. John is a TAG student who has been enrolled in TAG since he was in the second grade. However, TAG has no funding, which is a big problem. In addition, we've got James, who's considered DD, that is developmentally different. He was, after 6 years with IEPs, individualized education programs, and specialized teachers, could not spell his last name, could not count to 10, did not know his alphabet. We removed both our children from school, and Jonah added in a couple months later. At this point, Jimmy can read. Jimmy knows his alphabet. Jimmy can count. He can do numbers. He has his multiplication tables down. The specialist in the world couldn't get it done, but Mom could, because Mom knows the kid. The curriculum that was provided by Connections Academy is tantamount to why my son is educated and why my son's going to be able to read, why my other son is now not being stopped in school and now can't be stopped. Now he is advancing very rapidly because he's not bored. He's not causing problems.
All right, thank you. Your time is up, but your testimony, the quality of it, was worth far more than the minute and a half you got, so thank you. Sir?
Thank you, ma'am. My name is Charles Arthur. I'm the director of four elementary K-5 small charter schools in the Portland area. We currently are serving all total 450 children. I'm testifying in opposition to 621 as it pertains to the non-certified administrators and teachers provision. We feel that I'd like to describe how we use non-certified administrators and teachers and why we think a degree of flexibility is important. So these are the only 2 points I'd like to make.
Okay.
Because of the size of our schools, we have administrators that are half-time kindergarten teachers and half-time managers. Our most experienced and skillful teacher at each school, therefore, is a half-day kindergarten teacher and provides leadership for the whole school. We therefore need to draw from a large pool of teachers to fill that particular role. And we use non-certified teachers very sparingly. However, this flexibility has proven to be very important to us. We have found that a few of our teaching assistants that have college degrees, can pass teaching tests, can work as very effective teachers after working with us for 2 years as teaching assistants. This is a talent source that we think small specialty charter schools can put to use that adds quality to our schools. So in order to maintain this high quality for specialty programs such as in charter schools, we need some degree of flexibility in choosing our teaching and administrative staff.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Arthur. Appreciate your testimony. Ms. Hykus, you have the last few minutes. Where are you? Okay. And I'm sorry if none of the rest of you were not able to testify. We just couldn't help it today with the schedule. But we will take written testimony, and you can continue to submit testimony after the hearing as well, in writing or by email.
Good morning, Chair Walker, members of the committee. I'm Karin Hikas, and I'm the director of Oregon's Charter Schools Development Center, which is a statewide nonprofit organization that works with all types of folks involved in the charter school arena. And we oppose Senate Bill 621, and we encourage you to oppose it as well. I have a fairly lengthy written testimony, actually 12 pages, so I'm certainly not going to read all of that.
No, you won't be.
not in 5 minutes. But I do just want to emphasize that we feel that all four provisions embedded in Senate Bill 621 are antithetical to the legislative intent of RS 338. And the charter law, as it currently stands, was, you know, negotiated through three legislative sessions in the 1990s, and there were a lot of compromises reached in the final bill. And this current bill reopens at least three of the top 10 issues that were negotiated throughout those three legislative sessions. And we feel that, you know, certainly a 30-minute, even a one-hour, you know, hearing today doesn't allow us to thoroughly, you know, and I know that's not your choice, but it doesn't allow us all to thoroughly analyze all of these issues.
Right, and let me be really clear. We're not taking any action on this bill today.
Of course, certainly.
We would have more hearings on it if we move forward. So
certainly, I appreciate that. My point is that these are huge issues. These are not minor amendments to the law.
Okay.
This bill would overhaul the charter school law, and it would overhaul charter school practices. You know that there are things I would like to change in the charter school law. I don't think that it's perfect, but these are not minor amendments. And in terms of impact, you know, there are kind of different timelines for each of the provisions in the bill, in terms of whether they would impact current schools only or future schools only or all. And we don't feel like we have assurance that this bill would not affect currently operating schools. Maybe when they come up for renewal, that's pretty much been the practice. So that's why you have such a large showing today. And even if these provisions only impacted future schools, you still have a lot of folks very passionate about these issues, because we want the students who that you've heard from today and students like them who maybe don't have a charter school in their community yet, or maybe haven't come across one yet, we want those kids to have the same access to educational options that the kids have now in our current charter schools. We surveyed all of the charter schools in Oregon when this bill originally came to our attention so that we could have data about what is happening in these areas right now. And I just want to run through a couple things. We received surveys from 60 of the 69 charter schools in our state. So we feel it's fairly representative of the state situation. 82% of our charter school teachers are licensed by TSPC. 83% of them are highly qualified per NCLB. And my understanding is the state average is 92%. So certainly we're below the state average, but with, you know, a fraction of the funding, I think that's pretty decent. 60% of our charter school administrators are licenses. 80% of them have graduate degrees. 20% of our charter school staff are currently in collective bargaining units. They are employed by their school district, and therefore they're in the collective bargaining units. 80% have not taken advantage of the law that already allows them to form collective bargaining agreements. I think that's significant. And I don't know why we would want to require 80% of our charter school teachers to join a union they've already chosen not to join. In terms of enrollment, the 80-20 piece, 41% of the students in our charters, or 41% of our schools, excuse me, have student enrollments with over 20% of the students living outside of the district. About 70% of the students in our charter schools live in the sponsoring district. 30% live in other districts. Almost all of these are rural. One is in Portland. The rest are rural, where there are limited options. And about 9% of our charter schools operate in districts where 10% or more of the district's total K-12 students attend charters. Those that we're aware of include Camas Valley, Paisley, and Ione, which are essentially district-wide charter schools, Days Creek, Riddle Education Center, and Sheridan Japanese. We're not aware that any of these factors have been brought to anyone's attention as problematic, certainly not by the districts or by the schools that are personally, you know, involved in these schools. So if our data is any indication, this bill could impact 94% of our charter schools, almost all of them, and that concerns us greatly. I know I'm almost out of time. Mostly I wanted to share the survey data with you. And also say that I have a list of the 14 goals that OEA has for charter schools. And from what I can tell, our law and practice are meeting 11 of those 14, 80% of them. I can tell you that our current law and practice don't meet 80% of our goals. And there are a lot of other partners at the table who couldn't say that the current law and practice meets 80% of their goals. So I think currently, certainly OEA is a critical partner, and I think that their goals and concerns are being addressed. And I certainly can't fault them for trying to pursue 100% of their goals, but I think we all need to continue to do that. And there are a lot of us at the table, and I think we all need to collaboratively work together to address the pending policy and implementation issues.
Okay.
We appreciate the opportunity to talk to you. We appreciate your commitment to public education. Thank you.
And I appreciate your testimony and all of you who came up today. And I'm going to close the public hearing. And as I do, when you exit the room, can you please keep it quiet, because we're going to go right into our next bill. And I need to afford them their courtesy. Thank you all for coming. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 621. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 532. Quiet, please. Ms. Richardson, tell us about that bill.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 532 removes the requirement for charter schools to offer online courses to have at least 50% of students reside in the charter school district. That it would apply beginning the 2007-2008 school year. It declares an emergency and would take effect July 1st, 2007. Again, this is the bill that is, there's the same bill on the House side, HB 2037.
Okay. We're going to go till 9:35 or until I get the hook. We have Marshall Koba and Peter Stewart, who are behind this bill. If they'll come up, you'll have about 12, 15 minutes at the most, and then we have some people we need to hear from after you.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Marshall Koba, representing K-12 Incorporated this morning, here today in strong support of Senate Bill 532. 532 will remove the 50% rule, and I think, as Representative Cannon called it, an imperfect and blunt instrument.
He did.
With me is Peter Stewart. Peter is the Vice President of New Business Development with K-12 Incorporated, and Peter is an acknowledged leader and expert in the arena of online curriculum and virtual schools. Just two quick concepts I'd like to leave, and I think Peter will touch on it some more, is one is fairness. Fairness of the access for parents and students for school options in the world of virtual schools, and secondly is a monopoly. We believe that the bill that was passed last session and the inclusion of the 50% rule has created a realistic monopoly for the Scioto School District and has made it very difficult, if not impossible, for us to enter into this market and offer our curriculum to students and parents. My last comment is we pledge our assistance to find a resolution to this issue. We believe the issue is too important and the 50% law is too problematic to remain in law for any additional time following this session. I know that time is running short on some of the deadlines, and we would pledge our ultimate efforts here in the next 38 days to find a solution. I'd like to turn it to Peter. Thank you.
Okay. Let me ask you a question before you do, Mr. Stewart. Mr. Koba, the House is working on the same issue. Is it part of their little subgroup that they talked about? I mean, we got a presentation this morning.
Madam Chair, yes. There's a House Bill 2037. It had a hearing in the House.
Okay, so that's part of the testimony we got this morning.
Yes.
Okay, great. Mr. Stewart, welcome.
Thank you very much. My name is Peter Stewart. I'm the Senior Vice President of School Development for K-12. I've been a school teacher and principal for all of my adult life, and for the past 6 years, I've spent working on e-learning specifically. I've helped open up 17 statewide programs that enroll 25,000 students statewide or nationwide. And what I'd like to talk to you about kind of really are two things. The first is that one size in public education never fits all. The U.S. Distance Learning Association estimates that during the 2007-2008 school year, students in U.S. public elementary and secondary schools will take over 1 million web-based courses. That's next year. That's a huge growth of last year, and I think there were only 300,000 courses 2 years ago. Certainly, technological advances have helped improve both the number and quality of courses available, as well as access to them from schools, homes, libraries, and community centers. Equally important, however, is the growing consensus that in order to provide the greatest chances for success, schools need to be providing families and students with more options, whether traditional, alternative, online, or a combination of some or all of these. More of the same is no longer an option for public schools. In its review of e-learning specifically, the National Association of State Boards of Education reported that its study group on e-learning concludes that e-learning will improve American education in valuable ways and should be universally implemented as soon as possible. This group knows that already, and you implemented Senate Bill 1079 last year that created the Oregon Virtual School District. That's a great program for some students. That program is focused on high school students mostly, mostly part-time, one or two courses. It's a great program, but it's just one program. There are programs that have been set up around the country that focus on teen parents. There are programs that have been set up for students who have autism and Asperger's. There are programs that are set up for gifted education. And so the idea is not to limit this program just to one, just as you would in a regular traditional public school system, just have one size fits all. The same should hold true in the e-learning space. The second point that I would really like to make is that not all e-learning schools perform at the same level. This is true. We know that not all public schools perform at the same level. The same is true of e-learning programs. In her closing testimony in the House version of the same bill, Ms. Lori Wimmer-Wareland of the Oregon Education Association noted there are appropriate and exciting uses for computers in education without question, but there are dangers as well. And though Ms. Whalen and I were on different sides of the specific 50% clause, I agree with her assessment wholeheartedly. Ms. Whalen focused much of her attention on the findings of a report from the Colorado State Auditor, a report which was focused in great part on a single provider, the Hope Academy, which failed to meet basic measures of academic, operational, and legislative and legal compliance. However, the report also notes that specifically the Colorado Virtual Academy consistently performed near statewide levels in all subject areas. By far the largest and most successful e-learning school in the state of Colorado, COBA has used K-12's materials, curriculum, teacher training, administrative services, and technology for the past 5 years. I helped start that school. What I'd like to do now is, if you can look at your testimony, I have a series of data points that talk about how e-learning schools are doing, and specifically how the schools that we work with are operating. You'll see in the first one, it's about the Colorado CSAP reading scores. And the COBA school is by far the state's leader, and it goes down in size, you know, to programs on the right, with the Hope Academy trailing far behind. In Florida, our students with the Florida Virtual Academy, on average, score 17% better than the state averages. If you take a look in California, they do not just reporting of absolute scores, but then they compare schools by demographics. So schools that have the same level of socioeconomic, special ed, et cetera, are compared together. A perfect score is a 10. The schools that we work with in Northern California and Sonoma, in San Diego, received some of the few perfect scores in the state of California. And the Cava Kern School, which represents all of Los Angeles as well as adjoining areas, scored an 8, which would be like a B+. In Ohio, they've done some value-added testing, taking a look at where do the students who come to a new school come from, and how do they do over time. If you look at the second-to-last column, this is the Ohio Virtual Academy, its school, versus the testing pool, a number of selected schools that wanted further levels of accountability and to be studied by the Battelle Foundation. You'll see that at every reading level, our students did better over time than average schools. They were providing more value over time than the average schools that were tested. And so in sum, in our final program, the final charts show that the longer students are with us, the better they do. And so a research report I recently read reminded the audience that the plural of anecdote is not data. There are bad examples out there, for sure, but that does not mean that all these programs should be condemned. There's high needs for accountability. What I've shown you in this data here is that there are schools out there, including the ones that we work with, that are absolutely excelling, that are absolutely providing the type of choices that the charter school law is intended to provide. Removal of the 50% clause would allow hundreds of educators and families who have contacted us to work with the district and the Oregon Department of Education to create the type of statewide, high-performing e-learning schools that have been embraced by the legislative and regulatory bodies in most of your Western neighbors. Washington, California, Idaho, Nevada, Utah, and Arizona all have statewide e-learning schools that use the K-12 curriculum with great success. We understand in our bones that in order for this type of reform to succeed, it needs to be implemented correctly by both the schools and their authorizers. Fortunately, nationwide, this is no longer new ground. I welcome the opportunity to work together with you, members of your staff, members of the Oregon Department of Education, and others in seeing that the general promise of school choice, freedom to innovate, in return for absolute accountability, can be realized. The unintended consequence of the existing 50% rule is the state has created a monopoly for just one charter school. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stewart. I have a couple of questions.
Sure.
You're not at all suggesting that e-learning take the place of our regular public schools.
In my comments, I had to skip through them. I
read that.
This is not one size fits all, and we believe that. This works for some students.
This is supplemental education or some piece of alternative education
in
their plan?
It can also be full-time. There are many students who do this full-time. And it's the right move for many students. Homebound students, for instance, do well. The student who testified earlier from ORCA who was dysgraphic, he's a full-time student, is my guess. And that program is working well for that child because the regular classroom wasn't the proper venue. And so it's an option for some, which is why when you limit it to one district, there aren't enough students in that one district that it would warrant a program where you have to have a special ed director, a business manager, and things like that. And so by opening up to larger regions or statewide, for those students that it is the right fit, it's a great program. It doesn't replace regular public education. Most students will continue to choose to go there. But it is an option for those who seek another option.
And my second question, I have three. Who is best to administer those programs to make sure that they're complying with state law and making sure that students are getting what they bargained for? Is it the district or is it the State Department of Education?
Under current law, I believe that both do that. You have the district as the authorizer provides the primary layer of accountability according to the charter law, which is pretty mm-hmm. clear about what you have to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Oregon Department of Education is on top of that making sure that they're doing their job.
Okay. Then that's the answer I wanted to hear. The third one is, do the teachers who teach online through e-learning, do they ever interact with the students physically?
Absolutely. Well, I can only speak for the schools that we work with. Absolutely. One of the things that we do that might be different from other online providers is that we make sure that our teachers are assigned where the students are to the extent that that's possible. So, so if there are students in Ashland and there's enough students then that we'll have a teacher in that area so they can meet face-to-face. We do both. You know, using the jargon of today, it's synchronous and asynchronous learning. You know, asynchronous learning means that you have things that are available online so you can work 24/7. So if a student needs to be doing geometry at 2 o'clock in the morning, they can do that. But there are also synchronous parts. Those can be done both web-enabled, where we're able to work through a tool like Illuminate, mm-hmm. where if Senator Metzger was struggling with geometry, I can go and actually...
How'd you know?
I know, I'm telling you. And we can work, you know, through voice, and it would be as if I used to be a school teacher. It would be as if we were up at a whiteboard working together. But the best form of synchronous learning is that we're actually face-to-face. The schools that we work with run all kinds of field trips. We do all of our exams are proctored face-to-face. And in addition to that, you know, the students are social animals. They love getting together for events that are both academic and non-academic, that are focused on what they're studying in history. And if you're in Ashland, we'd want the kids going to Shakespeare plays. And so they do all those things.
Well, my question was prompted by Representative Cannon saying he didn't want his cousin in a basement in Philadelphia or wherever it was, you know, with a degree in history teaching virtual online classes, because I do think it's important that you have that physical connection. You need to actually meet or talk to the teacher rather than always seeing them on a TV screen, because that's just a little too surreal for me.
And we agree with that.
Question from Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Stewart, do you provide any resources to any public schools?
Oh, sure. Well, all the schools that we work with are public schools.
Well, I mean, in the conventional setting.
Sure. I mean, for instance, in your neighbor to the north, Washington, we work with the Steilacoom School District is the sponsor. There is no, they don't have a charter law there. We don't work with a charter. And then my company is a curriculum company, so we like to work with everybody. I mean, we provide not just the curriculum and materials, but also professional development, training. We do research and evaluation. So we work with districts all the time. Did that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. Great. Any other questions of the committee? All right. Does that conclude your presentation?
Finished.
All right. Well, thank you for the high-energy presentation and the observance of the time crunch we're under.
Thank you very much.
Okay, I'm calling the last three people up to testify. If you have different opinions or views, I'm sorry, but you're all going to be at the same table. Lori Wimmer Whalen, Tricia Smith, and Stephen Kafori. And we've got about no more than 10 minutes. I'm going to give you about 2 minutes or so, 2 to 3 minutes apiece, and because then I have to reopen the work session to allow Senator Metzger to vote on a previous bill, and then we need to scoot. Okay, who's going to go first?
Who's first?
All right, I'll start at that end. Ms. Whalen?
Good morning again for your record. Lori Wimmer Whalen representing the Oregon Education Association. I'm handing out both testimony and background research that I think you can peruse quickly. On behalf of our
46,000 members. We're here in opposition to 532, and it was very flattering to have my testimony brought to you for the record by the proponents of the bill. I'd like to point out that the RFP process for the Oregon Virtual School District, of which I'm a member of the advisory board, did enable the private providers to submit bids, so they could have participated in the state's online virtual education district. This brand new law passed in the last 48 hours of the 2005 session, as you may remember.
I know that.
And this 50% piece was one of the critical components in the compromise and collaboration to move that bill to the governor's desk. And so needless to say, we are unwilling to part with that. As a matter of fact, as I said in my previous testimony on the other bill, we have lowered our threshold request on Senate Bill 621 to the 50% because we wanted to be good sports about it and say that if we were asking you not to take it to zero, then we shouldn't take it to 80 either. That's the whole point. The reason for the 50%, I would argue that it's not a blunt instrument. I would say that based on the research that we've done, and particularly I will draw your attention to the audit report from the performance audit done by the legislature in Colorado with their proliferation of online programs. The brave new world of computer hell as teacher can sometimes get out of control. The proliferation in a three-year period there went from 2003 to 2006. They grew 50% in that period. The rapid expansion of private for-profit vendor-produced schools using tax dollars. The funding almost quadrupled for that from $8.4 to $32.8 million. And so as you can see, rapid and uncontrolled expansion can sometimes lead to the inability of states to get ahead of the quality issues inherent in this law. Our hope is that students who are consumers of public education have the state's backing with respect to maximizing their educational access to programs that perhaps they aren't able to get where they live or go to school, but which minimize the chance of unqualified or even opportunistic businesses that might exploit public dollars that flow these programs. And I'd like to say for the record that from my understanding of K-12 Inc., they're one of that is not one of the providers that Colorado looked at, that they had so many questions and troubles with, and that they seem to be a very good provider. Nonetheless, we do have a provider in the state of Oregon that has some performance problems that in their initial reviews, and it is the only one in the state that is a for-profit provider. There are issues around their contract. For example, the $2 million for technology and supplies that they have in their budget, which is about 50% of their budget, despite state law to the contrary, it stipulates that if the district should break its charter with that private provider, that the provider retains possession of that material they paid $2 million of taxpayer dollars for. That's just leasing the supplies and materials, and we really think that that's an example of some of the kinds of things that happen in these deals that are focused on money first and students second.
But Ms. Whalen, let me ask you quickly. Doesn't the Department of Ed have oversight over these contracts, or is this a contract negotiated with the local school district?
Madam Chair, my understanding is that state law notwithstanding, the district does have a contract with the charter, with the private sponsor, and the department probably could speak to what the extent of their scope is with respect to that oversight. But in Colorado, where that proliferation is already a good case study for us where not to go and why we created Senate Bill 1079, the students are performing poorly on their state exam. They're 4 to 6 times more likely to repeat a grade. The attrition rate is 3 to 4 times higher than the statewide average for students. The dropout rate was 3 to 6 times higher than the statewide rate. Almost half the schools failed to meet state and federal teacher qualification standards. Public money found its way into private religious schools. Incomplete criminal history checks were performed where there was contact. In Oregon, by the way, our one provider, there is no contact. You asked about that by the previous witness. There is no contact between the certified teachers and the students. There's no relational learning, and for elementary students, that is critical according to the research we've done.
In addition, there are student safety and security issues. Basic documentation was found lacking in 100% of the schools they reviewed, and the complaint process and boundary issues were also prolific.
So let me interrupt because I need to have you conclude, and I just want to sum that up. In Colorado, then, your testimony is that it really isn't just a vendor problem. It's a problem with the whole concept. Or is it the vendor that's responsible for all of these ails, these ailments that you're talking about, failure to meet these test standards?
Madam Chair, it is more than just a vendor problem.
More than just a vendor problem.
And the reason for it is there weren't any number of vendors in that state. There are 6,200 kids in those programs, and they're served by various different vendors. It was an open-door policy, and that's the point I'm trying to make. The constraint helps the state stay ahead of making sure there are quality controls. 1079 was crafted by the department with Senator Devlin as a way to make sure that in Oregon, there was quality control for student educational access because the state has an interest in protecting the educational rights of students.
Okay, so it's quality control. All right, thank you. Ms. Smith?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association, and I will keep my testimony the briefest you've heard this morning. OSEA opposes Senate Bill 532 for many of the reasons that you have just heard from Ms. Wimmer-Whalen, and I will not repeat. The one thing that I will add is that we are the tantamount issue for us in education is quality. And it's very important that the quality of our K-12 system be increased whenever possible. If virtual classes can help with that, and we believe that they can in some settings and during some parts of the day, that's great. But to remove restrictions on virtual schools and bring it a y'all come if you can will, we believe, threaten funding for school districts, brick-and-mortar school districts, and lessen our ability to really measure virtual schools as they enter Oregon's educational system and make sure that it is indeed a high-quality issue for our kids, not a threatened quality issue. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Gaffori, 2 minutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. members of the committee. My name is Stephen Gaffori. I'm here today representing Insight Schools. Insight Schools is a subsidiary of Apollo Group, which is the parent company for University of Phoenix. I've represented the University of Phoenix for about 10 years, and it's been really exciting to me to see what happens when the best of private industry and the best of concern for education meld together in one institution, how it's revolutionized higher education in the United States and provided a very high-quality education, focusing on a different sector of the target audience out there than the regular institutions that we think of higher learning. The state of Oregon has their state public schools and University of Oregon, Portland State, and the private schools, Lamb University and Reed. We look at a different target audience, and we do a different thing. We provide choice to students that have been underserved in the past. Insight Schools does the same thing. It's a new institution. We're operating now in Washington and Wisconsin. It's headquartered in Oregon, and we'd like to operate in the state of Oregon. I'd just like to say that I agree with everything I've heard from these two people to my left here, and that is that virtual education is something that's coming in the future. It is, however, subject to variations in quality, and therefore it's incumbent on the state of Oregon to ensure that quality control is instituted. We do not favor an open school situation where anyone who wants to come here can start out. We think that the state, both the local government and the state board, have obligations to set sideboards and quality controls. However, I think Senator Morris's question was not answered clearly, and I think it needs to be, and that is, if you have quality control from the state legislature and if you have accreditation from the national accrediting and you have licensed teachers, do you still need to have the 50% rule? And I think the answer is no. There is no reason for the 50% rule if you have the other safeguards. I'll tell you just a little bit about our school. We have a different target audience than other schools do. We are looking at students who are not in regular high schools at all now. About 10% of our students are students who have been formerly homeschooled. We operate only a high school program. We have students who are specialty students in terms of their athletes or they are performers and don't stay at home, so can't go to the regular schools. So they may be training for professional careers. We have students that are in special ed. We have students that are tagged and don't do well in either of these groups sometimes. And you've heard some of that testimony this morning in normal schools. We are not trying to depopulate the normal school. What we're looking at is students who are not in regular school. And we're targeting those schools so these children will have an option, a choice, and we think that that's what this legislature ought to be about, is to offer choices, high-quality choices, to students around the state.
Okay, Mr. Cavori, I'm sorry your time is up, and I appreciate your testimony. I was just handed a big packet from 621, so we're still getting testimony on that. Thank you all for coming. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 532. I need to reopen the work session on Senate Bill 479. Is there any objection to allowing Senator Metzger to vote on that bill? Hearing none. Senator Metzger, how do you vote?
Happily aye.
Okay. He's been recorded, and Senator Cruz is still excused. He's in a meeting this morning. All right, I'll close the work session on 479. I'll close the Senate Committee on Education and General Government, and we'll see you on the floor.